Well, it's great to be with you, and we want to welcome those who are joining us at our Steiner Ranch campus and our Brushy Creek campus. We're halfway through our lecture series. Really want to encourage you to come and bring your friends the next 2 weeks. The role of women and women's rights throughout history is the next lecture. We're going to be looking at that. And then the final one, the one on the university that Joey mentioned, will be led by a friend of mine, one of guys that I think are one of the foremost thinkers in Austin and in many ways in a lot of areas in sociology. Some of you are asking the question, how have I come to these first two lectures and heard a debunking of myths that are clearly not historical? How did those things get taught to me in college? And Glenn is going to help you understand how the university system today follows a model that allows a department to get together and actually leave facts out because they're crafting a narrative that would move everybody in a direction that they actually believe is more helpful or more beneficial. In other words, the idea that the university system sees itself as a place to dispense facts and knowledge and information for you to draw your own conclusions is not the current university system in America today. And Glenn is going to walk you through the history of how that came about and help you understand how to process what's coming out of the university. What I find is that so many people spend so much of their money to ensure that all of their kids get a good quality college education, and I think that's wonderful, but don't necessarily know the methodology behind the education that their kids are going to get, and therefore we're having a lecture series to kind of walk back through and set the record straight on a number of issues. Tonight we're diving in on the environment, and we're so glad you're here. This is not church. We're not going to spend a lot of time talking about the Bible and things like that. That's what we did on Sunday morning with this particular topic. We looked at that on Sunday morning. Today, we're really walking through the big myths related to this whole discussion of Christianity and the environment. And some of you may be thinking to yourself, I don't even know why Christianity would be brought up in a topic related to the environment. And that's where the myth comes in, and I'm going to walk you through that tonight. One of the most important global discussions today is our care for the environment. After all, we share the same air, we share the same water globally, and so how the environment gets cared for is important to every person. In the 1960s, people who were paying attention began to question why science and technology, working through both individuals, global corporations, and governments, why those things were making such a negative overall impact on our environment, and why government, business, and individuals seem to have so little care or feel any personal responsibility for the part that they were contributing. And so they began to ask the question, what causes people to shirk their responsibility to their neighbors and to the global community and just do whatever they want to related to the environment? Where does that come from? In other words, what is the cultural culprit giving people the impression that we are not responsible for our world? This brings me to the major myth that I want to discuss today, and here's what it is. The myth is that Christianity teaches that God created the world for humans, and nature is our property. We have a God-given right to exploit animals and the environment for our benefit without regard for suffering and the destruction it causes. That's the myth. After all, aren't we the darlings of creation? Aren't we special on the planet? Isn't everything put here by God for us to use and abuse? Aren't we the center of the universe, the center of the world? And isn't that what Christianity teaches? And so, based on that thinking, many environmentalists and scientists began to critique Christianity. In fact, Peter Sanger, in his book Animal Liberation in 1976, writes this. He says, it can no longer be maintained by anyone but a religious fanatic that man is the special darling of the whole universe, or that other animals were created to provide us with food, or that we have divine authority over them and divine permission to kill them. So where in 1976 did he get the idea that it was only religious fanatics who believed these kinds of things? Well, that idea was originally espoused in 1966 by historian Lynn White, who addressed the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and the topic of his paper was the historical roots of our ecological crisis. And in this paper, he lays out a case why Christianity is uniquely responsible as the ideology that's led to despoiling our world. And that was the whole basis of his argument. In fact, he goes on in that argument to suggest that unless we shed our world of Christianity and embrace a different kind of religion that doesn't view man as the highest being, we are in trouble. We are in trouble. We'll never, ever solve our global ecological problems. Now, this view that started in the 1960s has kind of worked its way down into pop culture. It doesn't take long before you actually hear this myth being communicated around. So, do we have any Eagles fans here? Any Eagles fans? I want to take you to their song from the Hotel California album, 1976, called The Last Resort. Look at the words here.
Missionaries did so many years ago. They even brought a neon sign. Jesus is coming. Brought the white man's burden down. Brought the white man's reign. Who will provide the grand design? What is yours and what is mine?
Some of you just waiting for the screaming guitar solo, right? Classic Eagles. So what's the message here? It's really interesting. So the message of the song here is the people moved to California, and they ruined it. And then they moved to Hawaii, and they ruined it. And they ruined it in the name and the banner of Christianity under the name of God, and brought their civilization and colonized the land and ruined the land and put up their Jesus Saves slogans everywhere. And in the course of doing that, they worship because they believe this world is worthless. It's heaven. That's what they're all living for. It's not this world. It's heaven. And so is the last resort California? I love the title of the song. It's brilliant. Is the last resort Hawaii? Is the last resort heaven? Or is the last resort that we've got to get rid of Christianity or we're never going to solve our ecological problems? Now, this idea is not just an idea for the Eagles. It actually starts at a very young age, and you can see it really communicated to kids. And I want you to notice in this the different worldviews between the two characters in the song. The different worldviews, one of them views the world as alive and divine, and the other one views the world as dead and utilitarian. Watch.
You think you own whatever land you land on. The earth is just a dead thing you can claim. But I know every rock and tree and creature has a life, has a spirit, has a name. You think the only people who are people are the people who look and think like you. But if you walk the footsteps of a stranger, you'll learn things you never knew, you never knew. Have you ever heard the wolf cry to the blue corn moon? Or asked the grinning bobcat why he grinned? Can you sing with all the voices of the mountain? Can you paint with all the colors of the wind? Can you paint with all the colors of the wind? Come run the hidden pine trails of the forest. Come taste the sun-sweet berries of the earth. Come roll in all the riches all around you. And for once, never wonder what they're worth. The rainstorm and the river are my brothers. The heron and the otter are my friends. And we are all connected to each other in a circle, in a hoop that never ends. How high the sycamore grow? If you cut it down, then you'll never know. And you'll never hear the wolf cry to the blue horn moon. But whether we are white or copper skinned, we need to sing with all the voices of the mountain. We need to paint with all the colors of the wind. You can own the earth, and still all you'll own is earth.
The idea is if we could return to classical paganism, the worship of nature, that everything in nature has its own soul, its own essence, its own divinity, then we would actually care for the environment again. So let me just level one little caution for you. The little caution is this: are we willing to give up science and rationality in order to do that? How high does the sycamore tree grow? We know how high it'll grow because we understand soil conditions. We understand how much rainfall an area gets. We understand the genetics of the plant. We understand the growing season. And we understand all that. Why? Because of science, right? Science, rationalism, experimentation. But if you live in a world of pantheism where everything has its own destiny, being, spirit, its own godhood, what happens? You say, well, I will never want to study the sycamore. It could grow forever. It's divine. It can do whatever it wants to do. You understand? In other words, old world paganism that viewed everything as mystical and divine is the actual opposite of science and rationality. that we learned 2 weeks ago came about through a Judeo-Christian understanding of the world. And I don't think our culture wants to give up rationalism and science to go back to a mystical place. But you say, well, if the only alternative to that is the exploitation of Christianity, then we begin to talk about why that's not true either. That's a myth as well. Now, I'm not the kind of person who's looking for a demon in every Disney movie. Okay, I'm not that person at all, but I do want to let you know that we have a generation of kids who've grown up. So everybody that has kids that grew up in the 80s and the 90s have been more inculcated with this kind of thinking about what's positive related to the environment, what's negative related to the environment, than what you can imagine, because that's what we've been talking about. And even though the scholars are talking about this at a scholarly level, it's actually down into pop culture. It's into our entertainment. The movie Avatar would be a great example of that. It's in our education system. It's in our government system. It's all the way through. And let me just suggest, I think that there's a better way. It's actually found in Christianity. Philip Sampson, in his book, The Six Modern Myths, which, by the way, this book has been so helpful in our research and study. It's a short book. Somebody was telling me earlier that they can't read all the books that we've recommended. This is one to get and read, okay? Philip Sampson, IBP Press, about Christianity and Western Civilization. Listen to what he says. He says, to the modern mind, it, talking about Christianity and this myth, it offered a way to preserve trust in science by pinning the responsibility for disaster on unpurged vestiges of the old enemy, religion. To those whose faith in the Enlightenment hope was waning, it opened romantic possibilities for a New Age pagan revival to replace the usurper religion and restore oneness with nature. In either case, the origin of the problem, the myth says, is Christianity. The question before us is this true? Again, I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about what the actual document of the Christian church is, which is the Bible. We talked about that Sunday, and if you want to understand what the Bible says about this, whether the Bible promotes it or doesn't promote it, that man is the center of the universe, everything revolves around him, he can exploit everything, the Bible teaches exactly the opposite. The Bible teaches that God is the center of the universe, that all creation, the whole planet, including man, belongs to God, and that man has a unique responsibility before God to take care of the world. That's what the actual Bible teaches. So if the Bible doesn't teach that, where did it come from? Where did this idea come from that man is the centerpiece of nature? You might be surprised, and then again, you might not. The ancient Greek philosopher Aristotle, who lived 384 to 322 BC, so 300 years before the birth of Christ, may be one of the most influential thinkers in all of the Western world. This guy is incredible. He has writings on geology, physics, metaphysics, epistemology. He developed our system of logic that we use today, biology and medicine and psychology. 300 years before the birth of Jesus, this guy was the primary thinker. And he has influenced the world in profound ways. When it came for the Catholic scholastic teachers, the ones who developed much of modern Catholicism in the 1100s to the 1700s, St. Thomas Aquinas, one of the greatest thinkers of the Catholic Church, was heavily influenced by Aristotle. In fact, part of his Summa was trying to take Aristotle's work in the Bible and find a way to put them together. Aristotle is the primary thinker behind the Enlightenment. So the Enlightenment period, which took place between 1650 and 1780, which laid the foundation for almost all of modernity, they were influenced significantly by Aristotle. So here's how it goes historically. Aristotle is the thinker. The Greek and Roman Empire is built on his ideas. And then his ideas are lost, and they're discovered by the scholastics, and they're discovered by the Enlightenment, and all of a sudden all this wisdom gets carried forward, and the world is able to shirk or shake off Christianity and the church get rid of it, which plunged the world into the Dark Ages. And now we have modernity and brilliance and light, and we still are trying to get rid of this religion that's ruining the world. That's one myth of history. It's absolutely not true. Absolutely not true. It wasn't that the church didn't have Aristotle. They did have Aristotle. They just rejected many of the teachings that he had. So in the first lecture, the lecture on science that we did, we learned that Aristotle, not the church, established that the earth was the center of the universe, immovable, and the sun revolved around the earth. It was he who established that, and the church went along with that as science until church scientists discovered that it wasn't true, and then they changed. When we talked about slavery, it was Aristotle that taught that slavery was natural. It was normal. It's the way the world was designed. It's supposed to be that way. And it was simply a part of nature that some groups needed to be dominated by other groups. When it comes to the environment, Aristotle said this. He said, plants exist for the sake of animals, and the other animals for the sake of man. Nature has made all the animals for the sake of man. And when you read his writings, you're going to discover that Aristotle said that humanity is actually the center of everything on the planet. And the idea that man owns the world and can do what he wants to with it, that came directly from Aristotle. It came directly from Aristotle. It didn't come from the Bible. So one of the things that's very significant about this is when Thomas Aquinas got it wrong, when you read the Summa and you see where Thomas Aquinas got it wrong, he doesn't quote the Bible. He quotes Aristotle. When he says that man is the measure of everything and the planet belongs to man to use as he wants to, he's not quoting the Bible. He's quoting Aristotle, one of his mentors and great thinkers. Now, I need to do this just for me, okay? It's just for me. You can listen in if you want to, but I need to do this just for me. The question we have to deal with historically is, did the Enlightenment actually propel man forward into modern thinking? Or did the Enlightenment lay the seeds for the devastation that we saw, not only in the French Revolution, but in all of the isms, the Nazisms, and much of what happened in communism of the last century? Now, clearly, Enlightenment thinkers did some absolutely wonderful things, and the American experiment is actually one example of Enlightenment ideas put into practice. But is the Enlightenment the time when man found itself and all of a sudden began to get rid of superstition? Historically, that is not true. And I want to show you what an Enlightenment thinker actually said. So, Edward Gibbons wrote a book. His book was The Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire. Two volumes. He was an Enlightenment thinker. And this was one of the guys that said he went back and they discovered ancient Rome and ancient Greek, the greatest civilizations that have ever existed on the planet. And that's what we need to get back to. Watch what he says about the reason for the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. This is just very, very interesting to me. So he says, talking about why the Roman Empire fell, the clergy successfully preached the doctrines of patience and pacil and enmity. I know, it's hard. I actually put the definition in there, contemptible timidity. In other words, the clergy were preaching restraint, back off, don't be aggressive. He says the active virtues of society were discouraged. Now, what were the active virtues of the Roman society? They conquered. They put people under bondage. They put people under the gladiatorial games. They were proud, strong, aggressive, take over. The Roman legions were the greatest armies that had ever been seen to that day. Unbelievable conquerors. He says the active virtues of society were discouraged, and the last remnants of the military spirit were buried in the cloister. That's buried in the monastery. A large portion of public and private wealth was consecrated to the specious demands of charity. What? Like, that's what ruined the Roman Empire? They cared about people? The poor? With charity and devotion. The soldiers' pay was lavished on the, listen to his words, the useless multitudes of, can you believe it, both sexes, who could only plead the merits of abstinence and chastity. Gibbons goes on to castigate the theological discord, religious factions, the distracted attention of the emperors from the military frontier to the church synod. Despite his obvious disgust with the debilitating effects of Christianity upon the Roman Empire, he does concede that the new state religion, quote, broke the violence of the fall and mollified the ferocious temper of the conquerors. For roughly 400 years, Rome had been pushing up into Europe and conquering every bit of it that it possibly could. When the Christian church began to take center stage in the Roman Empire, there was much more attention paid to the poor. Slaves were being liberated. People were starting to focus on higher virtues of society. Money was being distributed to help people in need. Both sexes were beginning to be recognized together. All of those terrible, terrible things that the Enlightenment thinkers thought were so horrible about the church. Now, ask yourself the question. Today, would you be more open to the idea that we need to help poor people than that we need to build a military machine and go conquer lands to put under us to rule and control? That's what Gibbons, the Enlightenment thinker, is talking about. And that's a lot of what took place during the Enlightenment period of time. So the idea that Christianity ruins everything actually came in that period when they wanted to return to what I would consider the barbarity of the past. And that's not to say all the Enlightenment thinkers did poorly. They had a lot of great ideas. And that's not to say that Aristotle was bad. It's just very different than the world we want to live in today. So in order to dispel the myth, that was my introduction. In order to dispel the myth, I want to show you several things that will help you understand what has happened in history. And here's the first one. We have historical evidence of destruction of the environment in pre-Christian and non-Christian societies. In other words, our exploitation of the environment didn't start with Christianity, and it certainly isn't modern. It's happened throughout history. Political philosopher William Ophuls states it this way: modern scholarship has demonstrated that the rise and fall of all ancient civilizations were deeply affected, if not determined, by such ecological factors as deforestation, salinization, and desertification. The ancient Mesopotamians, Egyptians, Greeks, and Romans, as well as the Mayans of the New World and successive dynasties in India and China, were all deeply implicated in a sometimes fatal process of ecological degradation and destruction. And the destruction did not stop at home, but was extended abroad through a process of imperialistic expansion. An exploitation that brought Nubian gold to Egypt, the cedars of Lebanon to Carthage, the lions of Africa to Rome, and slaves from everywhere to all of the ancient civilizations. Rome in particular ruthlessly mined captured provinces for their human and ecological wealth. In other words, modern scientists and anthropologists are starting just now to go back and study, like, what did the people do to their environment and how did that negatively affect their civilization's survival? And what they're beginning to discover is that this concept of human exploitation is universal. It's been going on for a long time. In fact, conquests, colonizing, enslaving, and stripping the environment in Manifest Destiny is not particularly modern, not particularly Western, not particularly European or American, and certainly not particularly Christian. This has been happening since the dawn of humanity. The idea that colonization just began with the discovery of the New World is a very shallow reading of history. Also, the idea that you would use your land up is a very shallow reading of history. Came across a really interesting book in the study. It's called Cannibals and Kings, The Origin of Cultures by Marvin Harris. He goes back and looks at the way people use their environment and how that shaped their society. For example, the practice of burning the brush in order to hunt animals was something that the Mayans practiced regularly. Well, think about what that does to the environment. It destroys the habitat, so guess what happens over time? There are no animals. He documents that the massive cannibalization that was taking place in the Mayan civilization, born first of all out of their human sacrifices and then actually eating people, was probably a result of the lack of protein-rich foods that were required to sustain the size of the civilization. So when Cortez landed on the beaches and saw what was taking place, the idea of savage didn't come to mind because he was such a backwards, politically non-correct individual. He saw human carnage at a level that was beyond imagination. And this guy's not a Christian. In fact, you might disagree with almost everything about who he is as a person, but this is the research that's starting to come out today, and people are finally beginning to recognize it. So this was going on throughout the world. In addition to that, in modern times, what we see taking place is that in the Western world, there's beginning to be a recognition that we do need to take care of the environment. And though it was slow in coming, we're starting to see it happen. But in areas of the world that haven't been influenced by Christianity, we see exactly the opposite taking place. And so here's a map of global air quality. It was taken today. And if you look at the map, you'll see these colors on the map. Actually, the colors where they're really isn't anything, or the areas where there really isn't anything, a small human population and almost no human footprint to exist in those areas. However, in the places where they are heavily populated, you'll see another set of colors. The green, the yellow, and the kind of the orangey color, like right there, those are on the positive side of the spectrum. The colors that are on the negative side of the spectrum are the red, the purple, and this pink color, the red being absolutely the worst. And if you look at the concentration of them, you see most of those in places in the world that are not predominantly influenced by Christianity. Now, I'm not trying to draw cause and effect. I'm not saying if everybody in those countries were Christian that there would be a different approach. Here's what I am saying. What I'm saying is to pick Christianity as the scapegoat for this doesn't make sense because it was happening before Christianity and it happens in places in the world where Christianity is not particularly present. Now, there is an explanation for some of this, and some of the explanation for some of this is that we've exported much of our technology to places in the world that have a lot of poverty. So what would we expect to get when you have large populations that are struggling to survive with the introduction of modern Western technology? And some of those places actually become the dumping ground for some of the waste that we don't actually want to deal with. But lest you begin to think that really we've got a handle on what's happening in the global world, I want you to see some pictures. How would it feel like to take your child to the park in Beijing? Like, what would you be thinking? Or maybe in Delhi, send your kids to school. Or the Philippines. It's not a figure of imagination. He is in a boat. That is a river. Now, we share the same air. We share the same water. That's one thing about the world. We are interconnected by those two resources, air and water. Even though our borders may not touch, so we may own our own land, we share air and water. That moves around. And so we've got issues in our world. So let me keep going here. So all that to say, not only does the Bible not teach it, but it doesn't prove itself out historically that Christianity is the cause of this. The second big issue that explodes this myth for us is that we have historical evidence the church has actually interpreted the Bible in support of environmental care. And I'm going to give you a quick overview of what the church has taught about these things. So let's go all the way back to the early Christian writers. Let's go back to the 300s. Remember, the church is founded in about 33 to 35 AD, right in that period of time. What did the early Christian writers say about it? In the early 300s, Basil made comments about how we need to pray for animals, which is interesting. And in addition to that, Basil also went on to talk about how it was the job of humanity to cultivate the earth in such a positive way that we complete the work that God has already started. In other words, this idea of a partnership with God. Ambrose, who said almost exactly the same thing, St. Ambrose. Going out a little bit further into the 400s, Chrysostom says this. He says, we need to treat animals well because animals were made by the same creator that we were created by, and we can learn from them. Now, one of the things I would suggest we learn from them is that you don't walk into a den and pick up a baby bear, even though Pocahontas was recommending that that could happen if you had the right worldview. But I want you to see what Augustine said. Augustine, maybe one of the most influential writers in the early church. Here's what he said. He said, therefore, it is not with respect to our convenience or discomfort, but with respect to their own nature that the creatures are glorifying to their artificer. In other words, the artist is God. The creatures, by their own nature, are glorifying God, and therefore it's not about our convenience or discomfort. It's not about whether the creatures on the planet make our life better or make our life worse. They're not here for us. They're here in their nature to demonstrate the glory of the artist who created them. That's a strong statement saying that the creation itself has value. And so he doesn't talk a lot about it, but Augustine addressed it in the early church. In addition to that, moving forward in history, the medieval liturgy that we read today, they have blessings on animals, blessings on stables. The music of the early church talked positively about the creation. The monasteries, particularly the Benedictine and the Franciscan monasteries, had a way of developing their monasteries so that they would actually fit in with the surroundings and enhance the surroundings. And those were considered some of those beautiful places on the planet. The Reformation had the biggest impact on this discussion. Now keep in mind, what happened in the Reformation was a return to the Bible. They felt like the church was getting too far into tradition. Remember, I talked a little bit about Thomas Aquinas and trying to take Aristotle and the Bible and try to fit them together? Too much into philosophy, too much into tradition. And the Reformation said, no, we need to get back to Scripture. So you would expect that if the Bible taught creation care, you would see it in the Reformation, and you do see it in the Reformation in amazing ways. Probably the most famous of all of the reformers, besides Martin Luther himself, in 1583, in his commentary of sermons on the book of Deuteronomy, here's what he says. He says, God has formed and created the brute beasts and vouchsafes, or that word means favors, to preserve them through his providence and provides them a food and, in a word, cares for them. And when he did put them in subjection to us, he did it with the condition that we should handle them gently, that as we deal rightfully with men, so we should use the like duty even toward the brute beast. In other words, what he's saying is, love your neighbor as yourself. If you've got animals, you should take care of them as you would take care of yourself. Just like you'd be fair with another person, that you'd be fair with your animals, whether they're plowing your field or pulling your carriage. It's your responsibility to care for them because God cares for them. God cares for them. Moving on to a really interesting person in history, the Puritan John Ray, who is called the father of British biology, was also a committed Puritan. And here's what he said. He rejected the view of Aristotle that was the popular view of the Enlightenment at the time. And in 1701, he wrote, "It is generally received opinion that all this visible world was created for man, that man is the end of the creation, as if there were no other end of any creature, but some way or other to be serviceable to man. But though this be vulgarly received, yet wise men nowadays think otherwise." In other words, he's rejecting Aristotle and the Enlightenment thinkers, and he's moving in a very different direction. The songs of the early church, particularly Isaac Watts, back in the 16 and 1700s, frequently spoke about creation and how God loves it and how it reflects him. And it was pretty easy that in the 1800s, these same ideas from the Puritans and the Reformers were picked up by the Methodists, Quakers, Evangelicals, as well as secular humanitarians and sentimentalists. And in contrast to those following the Enlightenment idea that nature exists for humanity, then pushed forward, seeing the lower life forms as more of a complex mechanism that needed to be dissected and studied for the purpose of science rather than having worth in and of itself. Even the idea of Darwinism, survival of the fittest, when you think about that. Now, again, I'm not blaming Darwin, but just the idea introduced that the struggle of an organism is against a hostile environment. Well, what happens when an organism has the ability to alter their hostile environment? You can see that paved the way for technology to significantly change the landscape to make it more hospitable for the organism that is the highest in the evolutionary order. Does that make sense? Much different than the symbiotic relationship that when we think of the universe today or we think about the world today, we think about the symbiosis, how plants and animals and people should work together to sustain and create an environment. That idea is coming out of Christianity. It's not coming out of the Enlightenment. And so, therefore, as the Enlightenment kind of pushed forward into technology that could shape and change the world to fit our evolving knowledge and our evolving race, it started to create major problems. Again, not coming from Christianity. So, Professor Lewis Moncrief in 1970, in his excellent article, "The Cultural Basis for Our Environmental Crisis," which one of the best things I read was his article that he wrote on this. It was actually published in Science, in the Science Journal. Here's what he says. He says, "The forces of democracy, technology, urbanization, increasing individual wealth, and aggressive attitude toward nature seem to be directly related to the environmental crisis that is now being confronted in the Western world." So he kind of lays the blame at the development of society in general. And I would suggest that the myth that Christianity is the culprit is again untrue. It's part of a narrative promoted by uninformed or worse, anti-Christian thinkers to find something other than the human condition, human selfishness, human greed, human self-focus, or even more difficult, science and technology that doesn't allow itself to have a moral compass because morality is considered religious and therefore ethics get thrown out. In a pure world where science is the only thing that matters and rationality is the only thing that matters, and in the absence of that, we run into all kinds of problems. Fortunately, we're making some progress in this area. Today, most Christian groups, from Catholics to Southern Baptists, not only have statements on the environment that are very clear, but they also have environmental groups that are supporting and actively working in environmental care. Now, I could talk about that a lot, but a picture is worth a thousand words. And I want you to see Christians in action. Watch this.
They say the great migration of wildebeests and zebras across the Serengeti ecosystem is one of nature's biggest spectacles. And that the rhino population in Kenya is steadily rising. Of all the animals in Africa and around the world, more than 80 different species can be found in this single 1,700-acre savanna. Welcome to Discovery Savannah. Just south of Austin, Texas, just north of Incredible. But wait, just over the next rise is something you'd never dream of. An environmentally friendly, fully sustainable landfill, recycling, and compost facility. And there's more, much more. Come with us as we take you on a tour of not one, but 12 interdependent business units whose mission is to change the world. But first, a brief word from the people who first envisioned something they call TDS.
When I came to Austin in 1971, I had nothing. And all I knew was growing up in a scrap metal yard. We were very lucky to have a mother and father who felt very strongly about a family and family values. So it was always from a standpoint of watching people grow up around us, literally working in a scrap yard all the time. I really did have a great role model in both my mom and my dad.
Bobby was going to school at UT, and I was running a scrap metal operation for my dad. Bobby came to me and he said, "What do you think about us going in business together with each other?" And he said, "I think there's some opportunities in the trash business." We were born in the recycling business, and we happen to be stewards over the environment. And so we are challenged by trying to do what's right, and we take the job that we have of being stewards of our environment very, very seriously. We've yet to have an environmental group to oppose us on anything, and we're very proud of that.
The bottom line is what we're trying to accomplish here is a safer, a cleaner, a better environment for lifetimes and generations to come.
So Bob and Jim Gregory landed in Austin, both committed Christians, and in the 70s when they started Texas Disposal System, they got down on their knees and they prayed and they said, "God, show us what we can do to be good stewards of our environment and make a positive impact on this place." Texas Disposal Systems today is now the crown jewel of the trash business. In fact, with their recycling facilities and their various reclamations, they've got people coming from all over the world to Austin, Texas to look at how they're doing it because it has become such an incredible model. In fact, the video I showed you part of is there's about a 9-minute video that shows you what they actually do with your trash. And so they're not only making a difference in their own approach, but they're actually making a difference helping each and every person in this room. And as they said briefly there, and as we know personally, these guys are doing it motivated by Jesus Christ and His command to be a good steward of the environment. Now, there are many people that are working in environmental causes. There's no question about that. These guys have actually taken it to the level of making it their life mission, and they're not alone on the planet. In fact, if you have interest in being involved, let me just give you a couple websites we'll put up here of some of the major groups that are working worldwide that you may want to check out, read, get involved with, think about. But when it comes to us, like, how do we deal with all of this? I mean, what do we do? How do we approach this? I would say to you guys, I realize this is a challenging topic. And the reason why it's a challenging topic is because much of it has a scientific basis to it. And for those of you who think science is settled, you don't understand science, which is always so bizarre to me when people say, man, science is proven, science is proven, science is proven. I'm glad we never stop studying and learning. Science is always overturning their theories and moving forward, which creates a specific challenge to us when it comes to the whole idea of climate change. You know, from the standpoint of whether climate change is man-made or whether climate change is something that actually just happens because of other factors, there are multiple factors that go into what our climate is and what it's going to be. But the early stages of it seem to be indicating that greenhouse gases may be having some kind of an effect. It's early. It's early in the whole process. But, you know, maybe some of you guys have some money in the bank that you would put into putting some solar panels on your house. Be something you could do, right? Something that you could do that in the long run is going to make a difference for you. See, those are the kind of things that we have to think about. And here's what we can't do. If you're here today and you call yourself a follower of Jesus Christ, to bow up and to be antagonistic in the conversation about creation care means that you are trailing rather than leading the discussion. Historically, the church has been out front because the church has the right understanding of the planet, that we are here as stewards to take care of it. And so therefore, being angry and antagonistic to people who are wrestling with global issues puts you in a defensive position. And that's not the way of Jesus. And so you may disagree with the science behind a particular idea. I mean, it's changing a lot. I mean, back in the 60s, what all the climatologists and all the scientists said was that the problem that's killing us is urbanization. People need to move out of the cities and move out onto family farms. That would solve the problem. Today, they totally disagree with that. They've learned that cities actually are cheaper to run. With people in the city, you can actually save resources better. You localize and strategically figure out how to do that. It's better to have urbanization, and it's also better in the long run to have industrial farms that can produce massive quantities of food for people who live in cities. Do you realize that New England is almost completely reforested today because almost all of our crops are now grown in the heartland of the United States? Everybody moves to the farm. What would have happened? And so what they said, the solution was in the 1960s and 70s, they now say, that was the wrong idea. Here's the other thing that's coming up, and this is going to be a big one, so I'll just throw it out there for you to wrestle with. It's a fad right now to buy local. But there's a lot of research that's coming in that growing avocados in the place where they naturally grow is a better use of resources. It costs less money than to try to grow avocados in a place where they don't naturally grow. And so therefore, producing massive food in the area of the world where it's native and natural and shipping it could actually be less environmentally negative than having your local farmer trying to figure out how to grow cherry trees in Austin. So there's a lot of questions that are going on here. So the two things I would say, number one, is don't be defensive. Like, enter into these conversations. What do you got to lose? If you're a Christian, you've got a calling. That calling is on your life to do a good job with what God's placed around you. Secondly, ask yourself the question, is there anything in my lifestyle of waste that I could change, wouldn't make a whole lot of difference, I could change that would make it a little bit better, because if everybody on the planet does a little bit, it has a large global impact. And third, if you feel particularly called to this, that's a great calling. Just like the Gregory brothers felt called to this and have turned it into a business that's making a huge impact on our city and in the world. In addition to that, they host groups that come out and use their facility that have raised over $2.5 million for charities. And they're using that for the glory of God. So get involved in those kinds of things. And so there's a whole lot that you can get excited about, that you can be involved in, that you can do to make a difference, to glorify God, because at the end of the day, you're not the center of the universe. God is, and this is his world. And those shrubs in your front yard, guess who they belong to, according to the Bible? They belong to him. That's the Christian understanding of the world. We use it in a positive way because God looks at our stewardship and the way that we use our financial, our money, in various ways to take care of ourselves and the world around us because we're a steward of that. That makes sense? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim. That was great. Well, I hope you have been texting and tweeting your questions in. And you can do that whether you're at the Lakeline campus or out at Brushy Creek or Steiner. But it's not too late. We're going to put the number and the hashtag up on the screen. So continue to text and tweet your questions, and we'll get them answered. Kate's already up here. So Kate is actually going to be asking Tim the questions, and she'll be moderating this time of Q&A. So Tim and Kate, off you go.
Okay, let's start out with defining some terms.
Okay.
There were a couple of questions about what does it mean in Genesis when God talks about ruling over creation, or what does that actually mean to have dominion over all things, as opposed to the idea that we're not the superior species?
Excellent. So the best thing you could do to get that question answered is to listen to the sermon from Sunday, because it goes through and explains all of that. But just to make it clear, dominion is not domination. And in the same way that God says he cares for the planet, and there are multiple passages of Scripture where he says that, that concept that we were given responsibility to care for nature is what's contained in that command. And what's so interesting in the world is oftentimes we look at the authority thing as power to give us the freedom to do whatever we want to. But when you take on the yoke of Jesus, power is only and always a responsibility on behalf of other people. And that's a very important distinction. That's why Jesus made it very clear that the Gentiles, they lorded over people. In other words, the guy in the corner office making the most money, he gets to boss everybody around, tell everybody what to do. It's all about him, and they work for him. But under Jesus, it's the opposite. The guy in the corner office is responsible to make sure that everybody's being taken care of. And that's what that word is referring to, and that's what Genesis is referring to.
Okay, another definition.
Okay.
You mentioned paganism several times.
Yes.
What exactly does that mean?
Okay, so paganism is a general word that when I talk about old age paganism, I probably should use the word animism. And that's the idea that basically, like, all of nature is God. And therefore, you know, God's in everything, and everything has a spirit, and everything has a life, and it's all part of the divine, and we're part of that as well. That's why ancient peoples and even some modern people today would worship trees or worship the environment, worship the stones, worship the animals, because they believed that God was in all of those things.
Good.
Okay. Are these your questions?
No, these are real. okay, next question.
She doesn't like me not to be precise. I can tell you that. It's the academic in her.
Okay, so you touched on this some, but maybe you could expand a little bit more. What would you say in response to people that claimed land in the past in the name of God and laid waste to the environment and the people who originally lived there, such as we think of the Crusaders or the colonization of America or even Manifest Destiny? How would you kind of think through that?
Okay, a couple things. What I would say is that's happened throughout history. That didn't start with the Americas. The Greeks, the Romans, the Sumerians, the Babylonians, the Egyptians, the Israelites, the Goths, the Visigoths. I mean, I could just go on and on. The Chinese, the Indian nations, the Native American nations. This is what humanity has done in the world. And whether people did it in the name of their God, which most of them did. I mean, the Romans would typically erect something to their gods or the Greeks after they won a victory. That's the nature of the world. So the first thing we got to have is just a kind of a level set. This is the problem of humanity. And so anybody that comes and drives a stake in the ground and says, this land now belongs to me, all the resources belong on it, and all the people are part of it, that's a little bit of what you addressed last week when the Pope condemned the colonization of the Canary Islands, where they were taking the people in the Canary Islands and making them slaves and stealing their resources. And the Pope actually condemned that in the 1500s rather than supporting it. So the idea that every place that a colonist landed, he claimed it in the name of God, when somebody gets a parking spot, cuts in front of you and pulls in that parking spot and says, thank you, God, you gave me a parking spot here. Like, we don't take all of that seriously, right? Because as we said last couple weeks, not every single person that is in a country that has a general religious view is actually operating under the authority of that. Now, the Crusades are really different. Very unique time, and that's the reason why the Crusades come up significantly, because when the Bishop of Constantinople asked the Pope in Rome to help him, because the pilgrims are being killed, at least that's what he said, the pilgrims are being killed, would you bring an army and come help us? It actually was the Pope endorsing a war. And historically, you've seen that very few times in the history of the Christian church, even though historians will claim that it happened. You just see very few times that there's any religious figure that holds big sway that is endorsing a military action by a government or transcending governments. The Crusades would be a long conversation. Would anybody like us to take that up one of these days? So, anybody that ever has done anything in the name of Christianity, I'm not justifying it at all. And there's been a lot of stupid and horrible things that people who claim to be Christians have done. What we're talking about here is the general movement of what Christianity's done positively. And if you go back and study the environmental sentiments of the 17, 18, and 1900s, you're going to find a heavy Christian influence there.
Okay, we've talked about Aristotle's ideas several times in the different lectures and how they kind of influenced the church's thinking. So why do you think that the church accepted some of these ideas or incorporated some of them when that did not align with the Bible?
That's a great question. What you see is in the early church, you see very little influence from Aristotle. Very little influence. The closer the people were to Aristotle's time, the less influence that Aristotle had. But keep in mind that the university system and the church were wed together. In other words, all the universities actually belonged to the church. Most of them were housed in buildings of the church. And most of the scientists and scholars were on the payroll of the church. Most of them had divinity degrees. And so when you think about the development of academia, here comes this Greek thinker who has done so much thinking in so many areas, and for an academic to get a hold of that and wrestle with that and try to figure out how they fit together, I really believe that the scholasticism that took place in the university, primarily in the Catholic Church from the 1100s up until the 1700s, that was academia, it was a move away from what does the Bible say and a move into kind of an academic experience. And that's why the Reformation was such a big move, because people said, we've got to get back to the Bible, and there was this huge schism that took place at that point in time. So you see very little influence, if any, of Aristotle in the Reformation, and you see very little in the early Catholic Church, but a lot in the middle Catholic Church.
How do you think that people of faith should negotiate the various theories of climate change?
It's a really good question. So here's what I would say. I do not have enough background or information to be able to tell you anything intelligently. I just don't. And so therefore, let me just give you an opinion. And this may prove to be very unsatisfactory, but let me just give you an opinion. If you consider yourself a Christian, and you know that it's your responsibility to take care of the world, then you should at least ask and answer the question, if there is a possibility that humanity is influencing climate change in a negative way, what are the minimum things, at least the minimum things, that I personally could do? And even if the only reason why you're doing them is so that you can connect with people in the culture that see this as the most important issue and wonder why Christianity is silent in a lot of cases, that would be a good starting point for you to talk about why you do what you do. Now, here's what I remember. I remember when cars started putting emission control, like I grew up in Michigan in the Lansing area, so Fisher-Body, Oldsmobile, all Ford, all those companies were there. And when they first started putting those emission control units on the cars, so the price of the car went up and the gas mileage went down, everybody was outraged that they were doing that. Like, they're ruining our economy. They're hurting us. Now, as we drive through cities that have less smog, we don't even think twice about how valuable and important that decision actually was. So the question could be, maybe we would be late adopters on some of the things that we could actually implement that wouldn't ruin our bank account or our quality of life, and maybe we'll find out 10 years from now that that was a really good idea. Maybe that's a really good idea. Or maybe we'll find out that wasn't such a good idea, but when I did it, if you're a Christian, when I did it, I was doing it as an act of worship to my God. Not a bad thing, right? So my big argument is, let's quit fighting. That's not the way of Jesus, to fight with everybody. And let's find a way to agree. I mean, we all agree, if you're a believer in Jesus, that the planet belongs to God. And so we want to take care of it. What can you do? I don't know. What can you do? You know, you're smart. Okay? And you don't have to agree that man is going to turn the polar ice caps into slush in the next week. You don't have to agree with that to say, what can I do? You want to go one more?
I have one more.
I knew you had one more.
Okay.
I could tell by that look.
Yeah, I have one more. Okay, so you gave the example of Pocahontas,
mm-hmm.
Colors of the Wind, great song. Although it's
a
myth.
I got beat up for that already, but go ahead.
But you mentioned that kids that grew up in the 80s and the 90s were especially inculcated by these messages. Can you think of any other kind of popular Pocahontas-type messages that maybe we would have grown up hearing and believing in and not really thinking critically about?
Well, I think that the primary myth today is that what happened with Western imperialism was a unique thing, and all of the people that were involved on the receiving end of that were all innocent people. And as I gave in the example of what Cortez saw when he landed on the shores of Mexico, I mean, we've all been taught that he landed there and there was a very sophisticated, highly developed, philosophically based tribe of thinkers who were sitting around taking care of the land and loving each other, and that's just not true. In fact, here's something that's really interesting. So I pulled up the wiki little brief on cannibalism in Mesoamerica. Here's what it says. First paragraph says, most anthropologists don't believe that cannibalism was widespread, if it existed at all. And then it gives a list of primary sources of people that were there at the time from in the 1500s, and what they wrote in their journals, and what they wrote in their histories, and what they laid out. So anthropologists today don't believe this, but like the only way they would know is if they actually studied what the people who were living in that day said about what was going on, and looked at the archaeological evidence of the human sacrifice machines that were built to know that, right? So in other words, that first statement is a statement of the way we want to see the world. It's not a statement of the way the world was. So it may be just a crazy thing that Cortez thought, I need to stop these guys from capturing and killing all of the other tribes around them, so we're going to put this down. It's at least a possibility that we need to get some Christian missionaries in here to teach these people that eating one another is a bad idea. But I would say that the majority of the younger generation has never been given that, at least as an option to think about. And so it's kind of a tough deal. But I mean, I could go through Dances with the Wolves. I mean, you guys all know the stories, you know, about the Western terrible people, and everybody else was nice. Well, I mean, I love that book. They document the Huron tribe in Canada were eating people. Whoa. So what would you say if you were a frontiersman and walked into that situation? I mean, the world is not all neutral. And so some of the things that happened in history are very ugly and very bad. And some of the things that happened to stop people from hurting each other and hurting other people may appear to be really bad, and they probably were. But there may have been some thinking behind it. So, I mean, that's what I would say. So, again, you know, you raised the issue of postmodernism last week, and I think that's a big challenge, because I think it's easy for your generation to say, you know, the more I learn and the more I listen to current scholarship, the more I realize what I was taught just isn't true, so I'm going to check out. Like, why bother to try to find out what the truth is? Everybody tells me lies. And I would just challenge you. Like, you're going to own the world. That's what Kate told you last week. Younger generation, you're going to own the world. The rest of us are getting old. We're going to be out of here soon. It's your world. So at some point in time, you've got to engage in understanding history, religion, science, philosophy. And you don't have to do it all yourself. That's part of the collective conversation. I hope you guys are talking to each other, having conversations, and learning from each other, and not afraid to talk about things that may be politically incorrect, because you may find truth there that actually is better than what political correctness could provide for you. And that's what we're advocating. That's where Saturated Austin Institute's all about, advocating. Let's discover truth, and let's learn how to deal with that in a culture where sometimes people are afraid to even have these conversations.